This is the second recording, and I'm going to do it, I hope, on this phone, of today's class, because I'm trying to make that resource available to you, and Audacity has just crashed on me again. Don't know why. All right, so we're talking why finance is different. Whether you are consuming financial services or providing them, it's different because there are really, I think, three key elements that make this context different from a privacy perspective. The first has to do with the need to reliably identify people. We've talked about anonymity, we've talked about pseudonymity, we've talked about pen names, you know, screen names, whether on the internet someone knows you're a dog or not. You walk into a museum or a movie theater if you're paying cash, or a library if you're, or a, you know, any place where you're not buying something. Your name is not a requirement for providing the goods, the services. I was in Barnes & Noble the other day. I had a cup of coffee. I read some books. Got some work done. Nobody asked me my name. Nobody needed my name. I drive down the highway. Nobody asks my name unless I get stopped. Nobody needs my name. But when you're talking about payments, almost always the person who's making the payment or providing the payment must be identified reliably. Why? What do we call it when a payment is made by someone whose identity is less than reliable? Fraud. Using someone else's credit card. Providing a fake bank account. Counterfeit money or a check with a fraudulent endorsement. The reason that we have to identify people arises out of how we do business. We don't all carry around sacks of gold. Well, maybe you do, I don't. We don't carry around our entire wealth, I hope. It's kind of tough to do. We buy things for more than we could carry, and we buy them far away. The only way that a mechanism like a credit card works is if you can identify the person with the authority to utilize that method. Otherwise, it's a non-reliable system. The only way reason checks work is because, or any kind of negotiable instrument, is that you have verifiable identity of the people who have the authority to give that money over. Back before we had credit cards and checks, we would have sight drafts. And a merchant would be traveling from Vienna to Amsterdam, want to buy goods in Amsterdam, couldn't carry around enough money, would provide an instrument saying, this piece of paper, when presented to my bank back in Vienna, they will give you the gold that I owe you. That's sort of the first check. Here, this piece of paper represents a claim on my bank, my actual money. Or two banks make arrangements that they would exchange them so you could cash it in locally. We needed to be able to do, as people, transactions far away from where we lived, with people whom we didn't know personally. So reputation was no longer enough. For more money than we could carry. And so we created all these instruments and mechanisms for making and accepting payments. And all of them revolve around authority and legitimacy, including the need to identify. So what does it mean? So what? If you have to reliably identify an account holder, what does that imply for privacy purposes? The store has now reliably identified the person who just made the purchase, which means it has that information. It now has the personally identifiable information, at least insofar as it needed to make the payment. I walked into Barnes & Noble, nobody there knew who I was. Had I paid for something with a credit card, though, Barnes & Noble would have my name and my credit card information. And whatever policies it then had about retaining and sharing personal information would go into effect. Banks and stores must be prepared to deal with personal information because they have to have it to work. Does that make any sense? You guys know what I'm talking about? I hope so. I don't know where I was going in the chapter two. If you are involved in this one category of information you will have is the personal identity of the individual making payments or providing, or right? You have to, or else the payment systems won't work absent an all cash business. So that's one thing that differentiates finance, the certainty of identity as part of the process. Now, it can go further than that. Sometimes businesses ask for more than they need. Case in point, Radio Shack. Anybody here ever buy anything the last few years from Radio Shack? Or Micro Center or a bunch of other stores? What happens when you go and you pay? What do they ask for? They want your phone number. Why do they want your phone number? Are they going to call you? Why do they want your phone number? Any idea? So they're going to text you, right? Wait a minute.
And then they take all the information also and ask you the address.
They don't always. Sometimes they just ask your phone number. And you ask them why, and they say, oh, so we can put you on our mailing list. Wait, what? You're taking my phone number so you can put me on your mailing list? I'm paying cash. You're taking my phone number. Why are they taking telephone numbers? Because with a telephone number, you could buy a database and get a whole host of personally identifiable information about your customers. For that matter, you could put it into anywho.com's reverse telephone directory. And most, at least landline numbers, will pop back out an address. But they don't need that to fulfill the transaction. They're going beyond it for their own business purposes, and they're taking on the additional burden of collecting that information or having it. But at the minimum, if you're not paying cash, they need your name. They need to know that you are the person who has the right to do that. Another unique concern has to do not with who you are or who the person is, but what they have, what wealth they have, where their accounts are, what their investments are. We have a balance in our society, a necessary balance when it comes to finance. On the one hand, there is a general desire for confidentiality of financial status information. People generally don't want the banks to be releasing their balances, even if they, there's nothing anyone can do with that. You don't want Citibank to be saying, here's a list of our account holders and how much money they have. No, it's not generally, or, you know, you're making a stuff. So here's our investment bank. Here's the portfolios of everyone who has an account with us. It's not done. There's certain regulations and certain conventions against disclosing financial holdings and financial dealings. Except, why is insider trading illegal? Big insider trading case this week, right? Some, you know, the guy who was on the managing director of, what was it, Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs, is accused of basically answering his buddy's questions about what Goldman was doing. His buddy's already in jail or been convicted. What's the harm in insider trading? Why is it bad? Why is insider trading bad?
They're gonna know about things that are going on before the public knows about it.
Is it that the essence of competition? Knowing more than the other guy? What do you mean it's a fair market system?
In theory.
A poor person should know all the information together so that nobody has an advantage over another in this market to make markets work.
Right. That is the theory of our market. Right. The price of a stock is supposed to take into account all relevant information as known by all potential buyers and sellers. Everyone knows everything. The stock is then properly priced, taking into account the risks and the possibilities, etc. So, how, beyond simply prohibiting insider trading, how else do we enable the market to know about, for example, how executives in the company see the company? What must executives do with regard to their holdings in their company, in the company? Right. One of the things that has to happen is if you are an officer or director or a significant shareholder in a publicly traded company who therefore is presumed to know more than the average person, you must disclose when you sell to the public. You must disclose when you buy and what your holdings are. Entirely opposite this general presumption. What I have is none of your business. But it has to be your business if what I have impacts potentially on market price. So we've got this balance here. There is this presumption of transparency in order to make our markets work. Wonderful theory. Not always true in total, but a wonderful theory. Mandated transparency as a means of proper pricing. So while some people have their accounts and their transactions private, other people don't. So in dealing with the idea of setting, whether it's setting rules or running one of these businesses, some will be confidential, some won't. Sometimes some contexts will, some won't. There are other examples, right? Generally speaking, bank deposits, publicized or not? Not. You walk into a bank with $45,000 in cash and hand it to the teller, what happens? It's not just the manager. What must the bank do? Anybody know? Why?
The amount of cash, any amount of cash over $10,000.
Why?
For the swell.
Anti money laundering.
Yeah. What's money laundering? What? You know, put it, it went through my Maytag? What's money laundering?
Money laundering is where you take funds from ill gotten gains and convert it into a variety of different mechanisms, structuring, layering to make it legal.
Like how? You can go buy a boat.
Buy a boat?
Right.
Actually, they used to do that. That's exactly what they used to do. Buy
right.
a boat for cash. And now, if you go try and buy a boat for cash, they have to report.
So wait, but then cash. How does that convert the boat, the money?
Well, at the time before they had to
right.
report.
So what happened to the boat?
The boat became an asset.
Right.
They could then legally sell.
Right. This is called money laundering. You have a whole lot of cash that didn't come from tracked legal sources. If you use a whole lot of cash to buy something, which is then legally sellable for close, look, doesn't matter, right? Oh no, I bought a boat for $100,000 with money I got from graft, extortion, and theft. I only got 90 grand for the boat. You lost $10,000? No! You've now gained $90,000 from graft, extortion, and theft. You don't care if you take a loss on the sale of the asset. It's all good. But meanwhile, the boat dealer has your cash, which it obtained through the legal sale of the boat. And it comes into the bank. At some point, federal authorities got wise and said, wait a minute. And they picked $10,000 as the amount above which banks must report transactions. They must report someone walked in with $40,000 in cash. Maybe that should be investigated. So there is the presumption of confidentiality, except when there is a need for disclosure, either because it's market forces or to fight crime, and it has nothing to do with reasonable, you know, it has nothing to do with a particular individual. There's this limit set. There are other kinds of processes where the usual confidentiality is set aside for various purposes. So it's just, it's the funny thing about money. Money does things. It can be used for things. It can be used to make things happen. And because of the unique nature of financial stuff, you've got this balance that you don't see. I won't say you don't see in any other context. It is rare that you see it. It's commonplace in finance. You'll see it in other contexts. And when we talk about medical privacy, for example, there are exceptions to medical privacy laws. We will again talk about them, but there are contexts, you know, look, doctors like lawyers have an obligation of confidentiality so that patients, like clients, will hopefully share enough information on all the things they're doing, even if they may not be legal, so that the doctor can give proper treatment. You don't want to tell the doctor you're, you know, addicted to cocaine. The doctor may prescribe for you a treatment that doesn't play well with cocaine. So doctors have this obligation of confidentiality, except if a doctor observes child abuse or other kinds of apparent harms or certain sexually transmitted diseases. Doctors and other healthcare professionals are required to report. But that's a very limited example, a very limited exception. And we'll talk next week a little bit about how far that extends, what kind of healthcare providers, is it just doctors and it goes beyond that? But generally speaking, it's not just doctors, teachers too. You know, preschool teachers are required to report if they think and viewed abuse. This, though, is systematic. It's systematized. It is embedded within our entire system. The confidentiality is limited when it comes to finance. And then, so we have who, right? Who they are, which is known. We have what they do or what they have. And here's this question, what they buy. Right? It's not money is used to buy things, to pay for things. And the question is, should our purchases to be kept confidential? Should they? Must they? How? Are there exceptions? Anyone know off the top of your head a situation where purchases must be kept confidential? The federal laws about certain kinds of purchases or transactions. Commonplace consumer ones. Anyone know the history of the Robert Bork hearings? You know who Robert Bork was? The hearings were what, 30 years ago this month, I think. Before I was really focused on the courts. Judge Robert Bork was nominated to the Supreme Court of the United States. During the hearings, among other things that were brought out in eventually to successfully derail the hearing, the nomination, the videos he rented and his taste in movies. Why that should be relevant, I don't know, but it was. After which, after which, 18 U.S.C. 2710 was enacted. 18 U.S.C. 2710 prevents disclosure of personally identifiable record rental records of pre-recorded video cassette tapes or similar audio-visual materials, with certain exceptions. Your video rentals must be kept confidential under federal law. There is a category of purchases that have specific statutory privacy protection. Not just who you are, but what you rented. Do you know that? Rental and sale records. Civil actions, there's even a private right of action embedded. Exclusion for personally identifiable information that came from video rental records, a requirement to destroy old records, and a preemption of any state law. It's unusual, though. It's unusual. There isn't, yeah.
So companies like Netflix have to get rid of their information after.
When Well, to answer that question, you have to see whether Netflix would be considered under that definition. Any person engaged in the business, in or affecting interstate foreign commerce of rental, sale, or delivery of pre-recorded video cassette tapes or similar audiovisual materials. I'm not sure streaming counts. And I suspect that has to be, you know, courts are going to interpret that. But this is one area of privacy protection for the use of money to purchase something. Hold on, find this article. But by contrast, I know I saw this the other day. Yeah, I'm not sure if that was. Yeah, that I did see that, but I don't think that's necessarily the. Okay. MasterCard and Visa in particular have been trying to figure out how to use their treasure trove of data about cardholders' spending habits to claw dollars from the ad markets. So their plan is they're basically going to track buying and provide those data in some way. It isn't clear if that some way will be anonymized, as they claim, or not. But the idea could also be that they would allow more targeted advertising based on your purchase. Think about this. Website says, we've got these users. We know who they are, we don't know what they buy. Visa, MasterCard, you know what they buy and who they are. So what we're going to do, Visa and MasterCard, is when we're about to send a web page whizzing its way to this user, we're going to ask you, what's the best ad to show them? And based on their purchase habits, you can make a recommendation. So they're not necessarily, in that context, disclosing your purchases. Exactly. May they? That's the question. Should they be prohibited from doing so? Maybe this was the article. Yeah, this was the article from the other day. Wall Street Journal. Which, of course, I have fully because I have a subscription. But selling access to the insights they gather about people with every credit card transaction. The credit card you use, they know what you bought. They know at least the stores you went to, and it's likely they have a record of what you bought. Certainly your grocery store does. If I would show you my Stop and Shop record right here, it would tell you what I bought. Amazon knows what you bought. You can search it, but what may they do with those data? It's a question of law. Is there a law about it? Well, if you bought a videotape, they're not allowed to disclose that. But what about other kinds of purchases? So ultimately, finance is different because of the type of information, because of these balances, but also because of the power of financial instruments. They can be used improperly to buy stuff. The reason you need that identity is otherwise people will buy things to which they're not entitled. A financial instrument projects the power of wealth at a distance, kind of metaphorical sense. but because of the potential impact, we have these issues. So, just to give you a sense of how this all plays out, a few diagrams. Anyone know what this is? I only know because I had to teach the course once. Very good. This is a check. This is the process through which a paper check is cleared. Drawer, person who has a checking account, issues, actually I think any negotiable instrument, to the payee. The payee deposits it into a depository bank in exchange for payment. The depository bank negotiates it with a forwarding bank, which then goes to a presenting bank, which then goes to a drawee or a payer bank, which then changes the, which then will deposit credit, will basically change the amount of money that the drawer has available. Who has personally identifiable information here about the drawer? And about what bank the drawer has and how much money the drawer claims to own and what it's paid for. This payee and the depository bank and the forwarding bank and the presenting bank and the drawing or the payer bank, all of them, by virtue of handling the check and verifying that the information on it is accurate, are collecting personally identifiable and financial information about the drawer. And the payee, for that matter. This system is why financial information is different. In order to make this to this work, all these players are involved. Which may remind you a little bit of that. Remember this? The modern version. Who's got personally identifiable information about the buyer when it comes to the purchase? Oh, let's see. Apparently Visa and MasterCard might release through their member bank. The site does, the warehouse could, all these processing institutions with regard to the credit card payment. If the courier is paid directly by the purchaser, so will the courier. In order to make money function, all these things have to happen. And the identity and the bank account information and the amount claimed all have to be part of that. Well, now I've given you a lot of information as to why we need laws. Are there any? Yeah. There are a few statutes of which to be aware. So, the three major ones here, really three major ones, and then the among the regulations that arise out of them are Regulation SP. So we have the Rights of Financial Privacy Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and Graham-Leach-Bliles. And I'll go over each of those in turn. But understand, so we have this General Right to Financial Privacy Act. These are all federal statutes. We'll look at its provisions. Fair Credit Reporting Act is just that. It is a statute designed to manage credit reports, which can otherwise be misused, abused, can make it impossible for credit to function, right? The credit reporting system is another one of those examples where, in order to make finance work, third parties are asked about personal information and purchase information and payment information and accounts, Experian, TransUnion, or whatever they're called these days. But those entities, not only do those entities have requirements under Fair Credit Reporting, to with whom they're sharing that information, under what circumstances, but what FCRA further does is put requirements on the recipients of credit report, the users of credit reports. And some of them may not be as familiar to you as others. So, okay. I think any of you who've ever sought credit, obtained it, been rejected for it, checked your credit report, have seen what they look like, right? You ever see a credit report? Anybody not seen a credit report? They're actually kind of frightening. And, you know, they track you all the way back. They track you usually by your Social Security number, which is not by federal law supposed to be used for as an identifier, but it is anyway. They show your bank accounts, your credit cards, your loans, how many times you were late in payments, right? The amount of credit you have available, and they give you a nice score. So who's entitled to use that? Well, a lot of people and a lot of entities in a lot of contexts. What about employers? Is an employer entitled to request a credit report? Okay. Why would an employer, not even an employer, a prospective employer, need a credit report? What business is it of a prospective employer where your credit is? Right. We'd like to hire you to drive our money truck. Or be a teller, or work the register where there's a lot of cash. Or work in our jewelry store. Or be in our accounting department. Are you in a lot of debt? Might you want to steal? Might you be, you know, vulnerable to extortion? Whatever. So there are conditions under which non-purchase contexts may evoke credit reports. There are conditions under which requests for credit. And by the way, one really important piece of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, let's take a look at some of these. I know I have them here. Hold on. Go away. Thank you. Tap, click. Take a look at this. To-do. Thank you. Here's our FCRA. Not in the most, accessible form. But, and I will make these citations available to you for you to take a look at. These I would suggest that you at least skim. Not after we've discussed them. But so the FCRA is 15 USC, 1681 et sec. And so we have these definitions. Right now, one of the things here is an adverse action report. And this is not privacy related generally, but if we're talking about the FCRA, I think it's useful for you to know about this. Fair Credit Reporting Act, sorry. Assuming that the credit report has been requested in an authorized way for authorized purchases, if the result is negative, is adverse, if the decision based upon that credit report is a rejection rather than an approval, is a decision not to hire rather than an offer of hiring, it's called an adverse action. It means a denial or cancellation of any increase in charge for reduction of the coverage of insurance or denial of employment or decision for employment purposes can be a promotion that adversely affects any current prospective employee, denial or cancellation of or change any license or benefit, right? Or actions made about consumer accounts and adverse to the issue. There is an adverse action. arising out of the credit report. The party that makes that adverse action, to take that adverse action, must tell the consumer, must provide notice. As a result of your credit report, we have turned you down, raised your rates, not hired you. And that's what I want to really highlight here. Lenders are aware of this. Sellers are generally speaking aware of this. Employers, not so much. So I'm reminding you, as the course of all this other discussion, should you be counseling a company on HR issues, on the rights to hire and fire, and it asks, and your client asks you, are we permitted to check our applicant's credit? You'll know to look at the Fair Credit Reporting Act to see under what circumstances, but you should also remember to tell your client, by the way, if you make an adverse determination, because of the credit report, you have to send a letter to them to provide notice. It's something that I didn't know about until a client asked me, so I'm sharing that with you. So, the FCRA also has certain identity protection. You know, here's permissible purposes, right? Section 1681B tells you under what circumstances it's permissible to access from a computer, a consumer reporting agency, a consumer report. Court act, court orders, written request by the consumer, and then what kind of legitimate transactions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are also requirements here about what has to go into a credit report. When must a request for credit or a request for report get written up in the report? You try to open a credit card account or borrow money, generally speaking, that request will go into your credit report for the next person to look at. Why? Why would a request for credit be relevant here?
Because they want to know if you're going out and asking everybody if they're going to have money.
Right, right. If someone comes to your business to borrow money, and you find out not only, you know, how many open accounts, but that he or she has been borrowing money repeatedly over the last short while, whether or not you're otherwise creditworthy, it may suggest to you that if there's a problem, you're not going to be first on the list for payment. But there are certain requests for information here that don't get put in. Creditworthiness without borrowing may not be reported. And so there are a lot of other things. We have here opting out for when your name may be reported other than at your request, and other kinds of privacy obligations, protections, etc. Look what's here. This is the Fair Credit Reporting Act. But what does 1681B, paragraph, I think, G, refer to? Protection of medical information. Are we talking about credit cards? Medical information? Why is medical information here? Anybody ever pay for a doctor with a credit card? Right? Okay. So, if your credit report would indicate
know, maybe went in for laser eye surgery. How many market, like, anybody get laser eye surgery? You all seem like a sharp-eyed crew, except for me. You did. Without going into too much of the detail, were you offered financing? Well, if they're going to offer you financing, they're issuing you credit. Right? Whether or not you took it, the concept of a medical practice, so in theory, right, in your credit report it would say, if you took that option, right, this person, one of his creditors, is Dr. Whatever Laser Eye Surgery. Gee. Isn't that disclosing that you had laser eye surgery? That's medical information. Yeah. Dr. Wise, sexual dysfunction clinic. There are contexts where a credit reporting agency will have health-related information by virtue of the fact that credit was used to facilitate it. Or insurance. And a lot. So, 15 U.S.C. 1681BG talks about the protection of medical information in the context of credit. Limitations on creditors. A creditor shall not obtain or use medical information pertaining to a pertaining to a consumer in connection with any determination of the consumer's eligibility or continued eligibility for credit. Oh, wait a minute. You've asked for a 30-year mortgage, but it says here that you've been going to a radiation oncology clinic. I'm not sure you're a good 30-year risk. That's not acceptable. That's not an acceptable use of credit report. Oh, you'd like to come into our adult-only community? But it says here you've been taking fertility treatment. That means you're going to have kids. We don't want you. Etc. Or our co-op. So there are requirements within FCRA. Another privacy requirement, what's in the type of information? What may or may not be in there? And so on. So in the context of credit, the FCRA has a great deal to say about what information may be collected, what may be shared, and how it may be used. Personal information, but not just personal information, financial personal information, medical personal information, which is happens to be collected in the course of credit, because that's how broad finance is. Questions? Okay. So,
what am I looking for here?
So in 1999, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act was passed, named for the three senators who were responsible, including Fred Graham, G-R-A-M-M. And just as when the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act was passed, in order to make it work, it included, as we'll see next week, requirements of health privacy because they were facilitating portability by moving everyone to electronic records for easy sharing, but easy sharing then made it easier to abuse and lose, etc. Similarly, Graham-Leach-Bliley is primarily about deregulating banks. It was Graham-Leach-Bliley that removed the requirements of a previous law called the Glass-Steagall Act, which required investment banks and savings banks to be separate. Some would say that Gramm's Bliley led almost directly to the financial industry collapse in 2008 or 7, discussions another time, because you had institutions where they were selling securities and also where they were issuing securities and they were also recommending investments, right? Or they were underwriting IPOs and also recommending investments, and or they were buying mortgages but not issuing them, right? So you had the lenders were separated from the people that actually held the mortgage, and you had mortgage-backed securities and credit default swaps and all these things that I can only barely refer to accurately. But in the context of Gramm-Leach-Bliley, one of the other things Congress required was the promulgation of financial privacy regulations. And you see them from in banking, etc. And so, one of the things we get out of it is Regulation SP, which obligates financial institutions that are covered by this regulation as opposed to others that are covered by banks, which have similar requirements, to provide notice about privacy policies, to describe when those institutions and may disclose non-public personal information to non-affiliated third parties, and requiring and enabling an opt-out. Here's the context. Here's what you generally need to understand about the Gramm-Leach-Bliley laws and the regulations like Regulation SP that arose from Gramm-Leach-Bliley. Here's the notion. Banks, credit card companies, have a lot of information about you. They know who you are, they know how much money you have, they know your account number. The assumption under Gramm-Leach-Bliley is that banks may permissibly, and financial service providers generally, may disclose non-account information about you. They may sell their customer list. They may market those data, not your account numbers, but non-financial information, to third parties as part of their business. They're permitted to do this. What they're required to do is to tell you about it. Clearly, simply, and annually, started a relationship. And as you go through Gramm-Leach-Bliley, and when I get my chapter done, you will see this, it differentiates between customers and consumers, sort of the general person who may be in contact with the institution, and then people who have an ongoing business relationship for the protection. But ultimately, financial service providers must provide notice when you start a relationship, and then annually, what information they have, what they do with it, with whom they're going to share it, and allow you to opt out. But the assumption is they're permitted to share it unless you say otherwise. So that's why every year you get
I hope this recording works. Every year you get an annual note. You get a privacy notice from every bank you have an account with, every credit card you have an account with, because they're required to do so under Gramm-Leach-Bliley. But you will take a look at that notice and compare it to the HIPAA notice you get when you start with a new healthcare provider And you will see that the Graham Leach Bly, the bank privacy notice is here, the HIPAA notice is here. Right? The requirements are lower, the bar is lower, the rights to share are much higher. Why? Why the difference? Yes, it's different laws. One is HIPAA, one is Graham Leach Bly. Why are the rights so much greater with financial institutions for non-account information? Why are the obligations so much stronger on health information? What do you think?
I think, because financial services companies have to share information.
Okay, although keep in mind, a lot of this has to do with sharing with non-affiliated companies, not just in the context of service.
Yeah.
All right? But the assumption here is they're permitted to unless you opt out. Right? That's not true with doctors. Why are doctors and hospitals and health insurance companies subject to greater regulation? For the answer to that, stay tuned. Have a good night. Which Muppet version?
The Muppet version of Bohemian Rhapsody.
I have it on my phone.
It's pretty much the best thing on the internet.
A lot of those.